One of the most pleasant, not surprise, but outcomes in the last 2 months is how strong our Sangha is and how on point, for lack of a better term, that we've just flowed into the truth of happiness and the outgrowth of like the discussions. There seems to be more organic back and forths, but all within the bumpers of the teachings. We're not getting into things outside of that where we're challenging it for challenge sake. That being said, magical and mystical, and here I'm going to give you a magical and mystical teaching right off the bat. His third one into the game, and they couldn't help but just let the Buddhist teachings stand on their own. They had to make it a spectacular, 1,000 people awakened immediately. And here I sat with John many times in his car saying, "John, I don't understand that. How is that possible? How is this guy Bahia, who never said a word after badgering the Buddha to teach him? He never said a word, but yet he awakened. How is that possible? Out of 1,000 fire worshipers who were just days before trying to figure out how to chop wood, and out of a miracle, the Buddha chopped all the wood and lit the wet wood, and the whole time I was like, John, why do they present it that way? What use of that is me when I'm trying to tell Julia to sit twice a day and to understand that it's a gradual process?" And he was like, "Dave, that's the Buddha's story. That's the Buddha's experience. Of course, that's miracles and magical and mystical. I believe that this practice is about investigation and experience. I bumped into something that Brian brought up that I've not bumped into, but I do not take it personal. I don't see it as a reflection on comparison. I see it as his personal experience. Your experience, Laura, is different than mine. But we're all within this bumper of the Dhamma. So oftentimes I think, well, is the teaching getting lost in the spectacular 1,000 people awakened, when at the same time, a great mind like Sariputta had to get instruction? He had to sit and be taught by the Buddha, but they couldn't even let that stand. It had to happen telepathically. And again, you got to sometimes punch up the script because it's a better sell versus the hard work of the Dhamma. The Dhamma is work. The Dhamma is resiliency and being steadfast, and to understand that this is not a chore of sitting. It's a tool to have a gentle building of your concentration, so therefore you can experience the three marks of existence. Not by miracle. The Buddha did not convert people by miracles. He converted with his teachings. That if you're going to call something a miracle, his Dhamma is that special. So when you listen to this, I'm not going to change any of John's words because I respect the man. And this chapter kind of stands by itself. His commentary is absolutely, like, it rolls back through the whole truth of happiness where we began. Concentration, mindfulness, all the parts in between are just building blocks to get to this experience of understanding this sixth sense base, independent origination. I guess this is where some teachers are a little different, where someone will say, "You don't need to learn dependent origination. You don't need to know the 12 links. You need to know the 12 links because you need to understand as you're experiencing it what it looks like." So if you don't know what, like, I refuse to like learn about becoming. because I can't grasp it yet. But I understand that I'm not gonna like throw it out the door. I'm gonna wait till it comes naturally. So, use that framework in the context of dependent origination when you hear these suttas and you can't quite place how it's, fitting in. And by the way, hi, Tom. The fire discourse. The Buddha presented his first discourses to the ascetics who he had previously befriended. These are the five guys that he was wandering around with. And at some point, he ditched them. He was like, I'm not learning anything with what they're doing. But these guys were on a path. These guys were in the same circles, the same teachers that the Buddha taught, learned with. These guys were rolling through. But they stuck together, and the Buddha went on his own way. The first discourse on the Four Noble Truths explained the cause of delusion in the world and the path to understanding. The second discourse explained how the perception of individuality arises and what forms the belief in self. About a month after the Buddha's first two discourses, he presented the fire discourse to approximately 1,000 followers. Upon hearing this short discourse, most of those attended awakened. Now, again, I think what they did was they split them up, just like in Anapanasati Sutta, and said, you take these 10, you take these 20, you take 40, and start teaching the Dhamma. Right there, that's miracle enough that with a little speck of dust in their eye, they came forth, took robes and an alms bowl, and sought for themselves Epasikino. That's enough of a miracle, if you want to call it something. The fire discourse presented below is a brief but insightful look at how the physical senses interpreted by the intellectual reinforces the belief in self. The Buddha was staying at Gaya Head with 1,000 monks. There he addressed the monks. Monks, the all is a flame. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Contact at the eye is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experiences as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the passions of fire. The fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, death, with sorrows, lamentations, pain, distress, and despair. And he continues with all. The ear is a flame. Sounds are a flame. The nose is a flame. Aromas are a flame. The tongue is a flame. Flavors are a flame. The body is a flame. Tactile sensations are a flame. The intellectual is a flame. Ideas are a flame. Consciousness at the intellect is a flame. And again, as we think about dependent origination and that flow of, because of this not understanding what reality is, we immediately create fabrications. At some point, we're saying, name and form, we're naming things, we're taking ownership of them. We are saying, I have preferences. And when my eye contact or my nose contact, my ears make contact with something, I'm either gonna like it, not like it, or be ambivalent about it. And therefore, I'm going to cling to, I want this thing to go away. I want this thing to stay. I want it to be a certain way. And therefore, there's suffering. Again, as in your path of learning, you'll figure out all those difficult concepts in between. But that's basically the flow of dependent origination. And whatever there is that arises in dependence of contact at the intellect, experiences pleasure, pain, or pleasure or pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame, I say, with birth, aging, death, with sorrows, lamentations, pain, stress, and despairs. Seeing thus the well-instructed disciple, I'll stop for a second. That's what we are. You cannot get this on the first go. You cannot get this because you happen to show up and listen to one sermon. You're well instructed. And just, I think I brought this up over the last couple of days. What we have is a very odd. We are householders who are not monks. We have decided as householders that we are going to develop this thing, this practice, sitting twice a day, coming to Sangha, doing independent study. Ram, is there anything like that? That's like that?
No, not without a very heavy structure and no, actually, it's
you pay for it, right?
Yeah, it doesn't exist because you can do courses here and there, but as John said, it was just. It ends up being more of a social thing than an actual practice. I haven't found it.
So we're being instructed. It's work. It's not a miracle. It's not a magical, mystical thing. And that's it. And if you look at John's, interpretation of this, it's not that much different than if you go in to see Dinosaur Bhikkhu's. It's straightforward. It's a teaching on the sixth sense base, and except he again could not help but throw a miracle on the end. Seeing thus, the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones grows in disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with forms, disenchanted with consciousness at the eye, disenchanted with contact at the eye, and whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact with the eye, experienced as pleasure, pain, neither pleasure nor pain. With that, too, he grows disenchanted. He grows disenchanted with the ear, the nose, with the tongue. He grows disenchanted with the body. He grows disenchanted with intellect, disenchanted with ideas, disenchanted with consciousness at the intellect, disenchanted with contact at the intellect. If you go back to the Vihiga Sutta, you're not saying throw away any form of interest in things, but the seen is just seen. And they talk about the end at the where 1,000 monks are released from taints and affluence. It just means that you can see something and not be so attached to it. It will cause pain. You can experience ideas and not take it personal. So therefore, it's going to be painful. It's going to cause stress. He grows disenchanted with intellect, disenchanted with ideas, disenchanted with consciousness of the intellect, disenchanted with contact at the intellect. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, he grows disenchanted with that too. Disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, he becomes fully released. With full release, there is knowledge. Fully released, he discerns that birth is ended. The holy life is fulfilled. The task is done. There is nothing further in this, for this world. That is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, the monks delighted at his word. And while this explanation was given, the hearts of the 1,000 monks, through no clinging or sustained, were fully released from fermentations and effluence. That's the end of that teaching. But there's a whole bunch of John's commentary. I'm going to read it because it really is quite good. It's just another page and a half. The Buddha is teaching through dependent origination, the components that make up the self are inflamed by the passions that arise from desire and aversion. This passion drives the worship of sensory fulfillment and reinforces dukkha. It's the preoccupation with dukkha that perpetuates delusion. The lessons of the thousand followers was how delusion and wrong view of self arises and is maintained. The Buddha taught that reacting to a phenomenon, contacting the senses, creates an identity that is attached to those sensations. The Eightfold Path is the framework for mindful recognition of the origination of dukkha and for the abandonment of those it causes. Awakening occurs as understanding develops through the Eightfold Path. Through the Eightfold Path, understanding of the nature of reality arises, and disenchantment with the six senses develops. Disenchanted with context sensory fulfillment, the mind quiets and wisdom arises. That's it. Let's go around a room. Why don't we do this? Let's see. Everyone, I'm going to flip you around and just like. Lazy Susan's never went well in my house. Centrifugal force. Why don't we call on Teacher Tom? Good morning or night.
Good evening from Thailand. I'm actually in a, just thinking about this teaching to the 1,000. I'm actually in the sort of this part of Northern Thailand, which is a bit of a mecca for hippies, basically. All, you know, wearing, what is it? Those sort of fishing pants anyway, all looking like hippies, right? And many people are here sort of searching for some kind of, you know, spirituality, some kind of enlightenment or whatever that might mean for them. And so, you know, I was thinking about these 1,000 followers that were, you know, listening to these discourses of the Buddha back then. Maybe they weren't that dissimilar, you know, in that they were in some ways ahead of others, right, in their era, in the sense that they were, you know, aware that this is not, you know, mainstream sort of ways of living are not going to bring ultimate satisfaction, and yet they were deluded still, right, because they hadn't really heard, you know, this teaching, and they hadn't, you know, really internalized the teaching around Four Noble Truths. You just wonder with that 1,000, those 1,000 followers, was it 1,000 people who had an aha moment where, just like we've all had aha moments, I think, right, coming to these teachings, where things have just suddenly clicked and we'd be like, wow, this is what I need to do. This is what I need to dedicate my life towards, right? The Dharma, it's the only way really to pursue a life of peace and less suffering. So maybe that was what it was. Alternatively, maybe, you know, they lived in a different world. Perhaps these 1,000 people have done a lot more training than anyone could have done, or most of us are capable of doing nowadays. Maybe they were less distracted than we are. Maybe they had, you know, they didn't have to contend with advertising and YouTube and all of these things. And so maybe they were actually a lot closer to awakening. So maybe this discourse of the Buddha was just that final thing that enabled them to sort of really fully awaken there and then. I guess we won't know, but it's For me, it's already enough to think that these teachings lead to the aha moments, because as you were sharing a moment ago, David, it all begins with that, right? It is, for most of us, a long and gradual journey, but with moments of awakening, mini moments of, you know, mini awakenings that can happen several times a day. So, you know, as long as we keep coming to class or studying the suttas, staying encouraged, believing that we can do it, then we can have these mini moments, and those mini moments can combine to essentially create a calmer and a more peaceful life. So that's all I've got. I kind of waffled a little bit there, but hopefully it wasn't too long. I'm done. Thanks for listening.
But more unauthorized storytelling. The Buddha did all these miracles with the first brother, the leader of the fire worshipers, and through a series of miracles, you know, the Buddha was like trying to get him to understand that this person wasn't an arahant. And finally, he basically said, "You're not an arahant. You're not doing anything to become an arahant." And with that, he threw himself in front of the Buddha and said, "I want to come forth." And the Buddha was like, "Well, we've got 500 people here that you're leading. You got any plans for them?" And he said, "Well, I'll go talk to my 500 fire worshipers." And he got in front of him and said, "I'm going with him. You guys do what you wish, but I'm off." They all said, "Well, we've been kind of watching the Buddha and hearing about this Buddha. And in my mind, I think they were coming to the conclusion that, much like the Kalamas, what they were in was not giving them the answers to probably the same questions we had."
Remember that in those times, I mean, now, the whole guru worshiping thing was very strong. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the guru at the head of whatever movement and philosophy. And when you come to them, you pretty much give your whole life over to them. And it's like, so to switch that from the fire worshiper to the Buddha, that wasn't a big thing. So what he was describing there, maybe, you know, that all the hearts and minds opened, was that all these monks said, "Okay, well, if our head guy is going that way, then we're going that way too, because we're part of that."
So there's 500. Well, there's 1,000. So where are the others? Well, when they decided that they were going to go with the Buddha, they cut off their matted hair. I always like to think that they're dreadlocked guys, you know, some brotherhood. And they cut off the dreadlocks and they take all their fire worshiping furniture and they throw it in the river. Throw it in the river. And it floats down the river. And the second brother lives down the river. And he was like, "What's all this stuff? That looks like my brother's stuff." So they all come up and check out what's going on with the brother. And the oldest brother said, "We're going with the Buddha. You guys want to come with us?" And they asked, "Is it a good thing? Is it the thing?" And the older brother said, "Yes." So there's that 300. So they end up going to Gaya, which is where the third brother was. We got a couple hundred. He says, "Is this a good thing?" And they agreed that this was a good thing. They went forth. They went to get their alms bowl and their robes. And then the teaching began. And then the beauty of the Buddhist teachings are going to be self-evident.
So, and by the way, that teaching was not about sudden enlightenment.
No.
That teaching was about
doing the work.
The other thing I wanted to point out is that you had the same kind of iffy feeling about Bahia, that was like a miraculous sudden enlightenment. I don't think it was. Yeah, I've done the hard work. The sort of starts with Bahia was revered in his community. And, you know, he had been a monk in seclusion for a long time. He was getting old.
Mm-hmm.
So there it was just that speck of dust left.
Yeah. Good point.
He's a he was missing, and he realized he was missing something. And the Buddha just said, yeah, this is what you're missing. When you're experiencing things, you're fabricating somebody who's experiencing this. That's the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't teach me anything else because that's the only thing that was missing.
Well, yeah. Gotcha. Jeff, is your lovely wife Deborah there?
She might be lurking in the background there somewhere.
Hello, Deborah, and we miss you.
Hello.
We're doing great here. That was a great teaching, David. I really, really appreciated your work and approach on that. I'm not taken by the miraculous, miracle, mystical stuff either, but if it's like a lot of similar things, sometimes sometimes it might have started as an allegory for or a way of saying what the Buddha said was really, really good. So they're going, how do we explain that in terms that people, how do we impress them with how effective that teaching was? Well, we could say it affected that many people that well. Or it could just easily be a translation issue, you know, but I don't think the point of that teaching should be, you know, whether it's a 999 or 1,000 or 1,001, that would miss the really importance of that, how succinct and how comprehensive that teaching is. I'm just, you know, I think like Tom said, you know, it could easily be you had a large group of people who had done as much work as they could on their own or through other different schools and were ready to hear and ready to understand what the Buddha had to say, whether it's fully awakened or just like Tom says, they had their big aha moment. I think is, we don't need to split that too much. I don't think. I think it, the strength of this teaching stands on its own, and how it was received by how many people is almost superfluous to the real message in here, is how I see it. I mean, I'm not trying to be critical of anything or anybody. It's just, you know, we could focus on, you know, what color robe they wore that day or something. It's immaterial, really, to me. That, for what that's worth.
Well, right. I appreciate that. My favorite sutta is Anapanasati Sutta. And the Buddha came upon this group of monks, split up into groups, learning the Dhamma. And to me, that's how it works. And that sutta could easily have ended with the same teaching with, and the monks sat and learned the Dhamma. So it's off. Who do we got back there? Anthony, good morning.
Good morning. You know, when I looked at the email for today and I saw the picture of John and, you know, it has his birth and death date, I started to get a little bit sad because I felt like, I don't know, I just felt like John went too early and I missed him. And then I looked at the dedication he wrote to me. I have an autographed copy here, and it's hard to believe it goes back to 2014. It's like a first copy. And then he says, be gentle with yourself and mindful of the Dhamma. And then I read the Fire Discourse, and it kind of, I realized John was very prepared for his demise, and that the Fire Discourse is kind of saying the same thing. It's saying, you know, just you can't, even though they deal with it through all the five senses, it actually, to me, comes down to how those five senses filter into your mind and how you become identified with things. And you're wishing things were either better like before or different in the future, but it's not accepting what is. And so I find it a really important discourse because all of the things that are in the Fire Discourse come and go: pleasure, pain, guilt, happiness. And it's just about anchoring yourself into where you are and not wishing that things would be any different. And accepting that a truly pleasurable thing will not last and an unpleasurable thing won't last. You know, and that, I guess that ties into impermanence. So I think it's a fitting way to end the book, because it's truly, I think, when you're able to just appreciate what is in this moment, your life becomes a lot more rich, and it opens you up to appreciate the pleasures of life as it unfolds. So that's my little two cents.
Thank you, Anthony. Does anyone have to leave? You're good?
I'm good.
You good? Tracy, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Dave, for the teaching. And Anthony, what you just said was really beautiful, by the way. So thank you for sharing that. So this couldn't have come at a better time. I agree that having this as the last teaching in the Truth of Happiness is really profound for me. When I started this course, I had abandoned something that I thought was a practice that I needed, with a little bit of courage and faith that I could go through this experience with the Sangha without it. And throughout the entire 10 weeks that we've been doing this, I've seen a lot of benefits. It's opened my mind in so many ways. And in the last week, just coincidentally, or maybe it is a miracle, who knows, right? Like, going back to that, there's another thing that I've been doing my whole life that I thought I was on the right path, and I thought, you know, this is all exactly what I need. But I've been having a lot of doubts about that. And to me, this Fire Discourse really solidifies something in me that says you can replace what the Buddha was saying, as I heard it, is fire could be anything. Fire could be family. Fire could be, you know, being an athlete, like John used to say, you know, wanting to play center field for the Yankees. Fire could be being a husband. And what the Buddha was saying to these fire worshipers was that everything is a flame. Like, you're attached to the fire. And if you abandon the fire, then you will be set free. It's the thing that you are attached to that's actually holding you back from peace and liberation. And I have my own fire thing. And it just kind of opened my eyes to that. And again, like taking another step to say, I'm another sort of invitation to further develop the Dhamma and abandon those things that I thought were the right path that just are not. And so, so thank you. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Tristan. Dr. Kevin. Good morning.
Morning. Hello, everyone. David, thank you for the teaching. It's a great way to wrap up the course, my categories too. I think, awakening is difficult. Awakening may never come for most of us, but I think in our Sangha, there are many of us who just have a speck of dust in their eye. And awakening could be imminent for any one of us. We shouldn't lose heart that it's, difficult or impossible, and we have the path to be able to do it. So, and just at the end of this course again, I just, realize again and just reiterate how fortunate I was to meet John at the very beginning of my dabbling into meditation and Buddhism, and then being put right on this right, correct path. And now I want to thank all the teachers. With John's prescience, he decided he needed to have a plan, and he came up with a great plan to train all your teachers, and the teachers have been just fabulous in picking up this course. So I want to thank you, and peace to all.
Thank you, Kevin. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. I just want to join last couple of people and a couple of and several important points. Kevin, that I totally agree with you that the teachers have done a great job, and John did a great job teaching them. But I'm even surprised how well sometimes they teach. Not to diminish in any way, but it's just you guys have learned to such a great depth. So thank you. Also wanted to follow up on Tracy's point. She said she had a fire thing, and let's just say it's a hobby or something that really interests us, my assumption. But even if we feel passionate about something that we do, I guess we still should, the message is not to get attached to it, right? And that's hard. So, but I think that's necessary. And I won't dwell on this anymore, but I think this I could talk about it a lot more. And then, but and what Anthony said, I think a lot about John's demise also, and how he seemed to have been prepared for his own demise. And just thinking back in the last several months while he was still teaching, I was picking up on things. And I, what a great way to prepare yourself for departure, without preparing yourself for the pain, to separate physical and aging pain from the mental anguish. What a great accomplishment. So That's all I have. Thank you all.
Nicely said, Mark. Thank you. Raquel, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, David, for the teaching and everybody else for the comments so far. Wonderful comments. I'm experiencing a little cold and taking things that's making me a little child, so I'm not probably at my best to talk today, but this is an experience that, like Anthony said, not accepting what it is. I wish I was, you know, I'm thinking, why am I sick? You know, I don't want this. But the fact that we need to accept things as it is makes things a lot easier to go through, not clinging into what you dislike and but like this quote. But I I'm grateful also for the entire Sangha. Everybody, was beautiful to see the pictures that Matthew sent yesterday about the trees that was planted for John in John's memory. And I'm very grateful for this whole experience, because while I'm not there yet, and I hope that we all can achieve this awakenings, even in like Tom said, like those mini awakenings that can happen during a few times in, or either during the day or in your lifetime. It's worth it. It's better than nothing. But I hope we all will achieve a full awakening someday. So thank you.
Thank you, Raquel. Zach, good morning.
Morning. I think just in continuation of the discussion of the Thousand Monks Awakening, I have a really hard time with miracles and magical thinking, which is part of what drew me to this practice and why I think it's been so helpful and impactful. And as it say right there, potential for liberation resides at each moment that occurs. And there have been many, many moments in this room and personally by myself where there's that just comes together, and doesn't mean you don't have to continue to work at it and meditate and concentrate, because I've lost that concentration to a degree over the last month, and I found it and it's practice. That's why we call it a practice. And I love to see just Tracy's development, and to me it's always Tracy. It's amazing to see how this has impacted you, because I feel similarly in my own way. But it's not a miracle, right? It's your right effort. I think it's not a miracle. It's been my right effort. And I think it's the same for folks in this room. So if it was a miracle, we wouldn't have to continue practicing, as it would be done.
The Buddha had that supernatural power. He would just
blow it off.
Everyone. It so. Is.
It's the right effort.
Yeah. You know, those flashes that Tom mentioned, it's the where you are at with your understanding and mindfulness, and those flashes of right view are always zipping around. And what this practice is to develop concentration so you can be mindful and see what reality is and not dip into delusion. And there's a balance. You see it in each one of us, and you see when you fall out of it, but you understand why. You understand, you're aware of it happening, and you take a breath. And maybe you're not in right view automatically. You created that space That's that wise restraint. And then to me, that propels you to sit, come to Sangha, and learn. That's way better than a miracle.
So. There's a miracle in status quo. We just get bored with that miracle. Chasing after something else after you had that genie in a bottle. You get your three wishes, and you're like, shit, I wish I had a fourth wish.
Yeah.
That should have been your third wish.
I think there's a rule.
Three more wishes.
Brian, welcome. Our friend Brian came out to Juan. Helped dig a hole.
Yeah, I got dirty and stuff.
Got dirty. No one got hurt.
You got hurt.
And he's here with us this morning.
Thank you, my friend.
Is this?
Yeah, you're good. Okay. Yeah, hi. There's me. Yeah, through ignorance of ourself and through this impersonal phenomena that is contacting our senses all day and all night. We identify with that contact, we identify with that phenomenon, we call it ours. We either want it or we don't want it. We develop passion around some of that. We get really identified with that. And when we lose that, we suffer. All the Buddha is saying is being mindful of this mechanism of dependent origination. Be mindful of impermanence. Be mindful of anatta. Be mindful of dukkha. Abandon it in the moment. Who cares about miracles? Right? That's a view. I think miracles exist. I think they don't exist. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. That's a view. That's suffering. So the middle path is staying in between those fixed views of yes, no, stay out of the binary. That's where the suffering is. That's what the Buddha was saying about these fires for passion, right? It's unnecessary. It just leads to suffering.
Thank you, Brian. As always, brilliant. Brilliant. Always brilliant, right? We should make Brian.
Sorry, somebody's humble.
Yeah, no.
We should make Brian like be the final word because then it's like this brilliant like synopsis and
recap. Just be the recapper.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Recapper.
They kind of diminished what.
And I get
it's
to,
fine. It's
I
fine.
Get to follow him.
I know. Sorry.
Yeah.
Becky.
Thank you, David. And I just want to reiterate that. Well, actually, not reiterate. I really think the real miracle here, if there's a miracle, in my opinion, the miracle is John Haspel. Because he had the foresight, first of all, to train these people. As people have said, he was obviously preparing. And the way you guys have just pulled together, just done it, you're just doing it, which is, it's just like almost like a smooth transition. I mean, we're not behind the scenes, so we don't know what's happening, but it seems so perfectly fine from where I'm sitting. And the other miracle about John is that he restored the Buddha's true Dhamma. I haven't done any studying about other people who have written about the Buddha, but this teaching, this Dhamma, the way John has presented it and has restored it and has recorded it, I think should be the fourth jewel. I mean, it is amazing that we have all of this. And it just feels so right to me. I'm with
Zach.
That it appealed to me from the very beginning, because it wasn't miraculous, because it was something that everyone can do, and most of all, because we are responsible for our own happiness. And if we follow just the fact that we know that there's a right view, even if we don't have those many moments very often, mm-hmm. when we do, that moment of empathico, and when we don't, knowing that what we have to do, knowing that right effort, meditation, going to Sangha is going to increase the number of those right view moments that we have. And that we can become disenchanted. We can not personalize. And we can develop dispassion, which will lead to knowledge. So thank you all.
That's a good follow-up. And I would just follow kind of with our purpose statement. As teachers and students challenge and question and do it within right investigation, don't take it just because I presented it or John did. If you have a question or a challenge, or I was the worst car ride with John ever, twice a week, because I didn't want to talk about anything other than just curious things about the Dhamma. He wanted to talk about climate change and a war and politics, and I'm the worst because I just wanted to talk and say, David, I don't mind because you keep it within wise investigation. So I ask everyone to do the same. Don't take it on faith. Don't take it on just because John Haspel wrote it. If it doesn't look right, question it in a respectful Dhamma investigation manner. And I think that, and again, Brian said things last couple of days that like said that. Look critically at what we're teaching. If it doesn't look right, sit down with this guy and sit down with a Jen, these brilliant minds that have really thought this stuff through. And that will help sometimes dislodging or this sticking point. It's not the answer because you have to experience it personally, but that's the process of a vibrant Sangha. So I know everyone appreciates the teachers, but it really is the group. It's not, you know, presentation and listening. It really is about investigation. But thank you, Becky. Laura?
Not much to add. I love going through this Truth of Happiness course every time, because there's, again, like I said in a previous class, there's acupuncture points that hit me every single time and help me to become more awake and less like asleep and just mindless to what's going on, you know, my contribution to my own stress. So thank you again to all of the teachers. And it's not just your teaching here in the Sangha, it's really your exemplary practice too that really, you know, helps me going. So thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Very nice of you. Good morning, Adam.
Morning, David. But that was an engaging way you presented that. Thank you. I was going to ask about the use of the word enchantment and this idea of these physical senses being charming, like they charm you into believing in them, becoming attached to them. Mm-hmm. But then Tracy mentioned this idea of that we each have our own flames. I think that's fascinating, so interesting, and really true. You know, they're the physical sensations they talk about in the chapter, but this idea we each have these things of our own that we identify with and attach ourselves to that become our own personal flame. Maybe there's probably more than one for any of us.
Sure.
But the idea of it being a personalized thing is really interesting, and you know how it really reinforces that attachment to something that is completely gossamer. So I say thanks to Tracy for teasing that out.
If you really think about dependent origination and why there's conflict in the world, just we are going through this. and we each are experiencing fabrication and our likes and dislikes. And what do? We tend to gather like-minded people. And we have this echo chamber of supporting. So we tend to be in there. So when you hear like a Tracy saying, well, we each have our fires. Well, yeah, but I tend to like want to be with the fires that I like being with you folks, because we are wise associates. But when you have confirmation bias, I tend to want to be in just this group that is confirming my own fire. And I don't like Brian's fire, because
my fire's better.
And this is where we grow up, we become, whether it's on a personal basis or next town over basis or country's basis. The world is a flame, but it's our individual flame of like this passion of me. Mm-hmm. My passion is I making, simply put, it's I making, it's selfishness. And this enchantment is the process of this practice. You described that beautifully, of being able to see it and see that it's impermanent, see that it's causing my own suffering. You know, I am contributing to this. This passion, this love, this need for something to be the way I want it is causing me pain and stress, because it's not going to last. It's going to be challenged. So this enchantment, this passion, that's the process of developing your mindfulness. So you can see it coming. You said it. You can see it coming. You can experience it. And that's right view. That's right. That's all right view is I understand this moment. And there's no delusion. There's no mindlessness.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm experiencing a lot of changes in form lately. And I don't have a ton of control, and like that's, you know, we our practice, everything is impermanent, which is really grounding. But related to your response to Becky's comment, that really resonates with me, because I think Zach and I are about to embark on a whole new chapter of attachment that we have not experienced before as new parents, right? So I'm not getting ahead of it. It's like, I'm going to struggle with my practice harder than I've ever had before. And thinking about that, I'm going to be prepared for that. Grateful to just be a few steps away. And excited to deepen my practice in this new chapter with you all. That's so
exciting.
Thanks in advance for more of this.
And I would only say my daughters are grown. And because of this practice, I'm with them. I'm with them each moment. I'm with them. I'm in it. I'm absolutely in it. And that's the difference. I can be with them and not be attached, because I understand it's impermanent. Because my understanding of impermanence, I don't take it for granted. I'm in the ball game with those two.
Think of it as unconditioned, not attached. Mm-hmm.
Can you say more?
Unconditioned love is love without attachment.
Yeah, we'll try that.
But also, when we say attached, I just totally lost my thought.
Because what we're really talking about is what you think is that it doesn't need to be any different than what it is.
Right.
It is. So you contributing that second arrow, that's no good. It's happening anyways. So this disenchantment is simply saying, What is seen is seen. What is experienced is experienced. Good, bad, there's no dodging dukkha. You can try to press it up and like try to support it and hold it back and want your children to be successful and safe. And the reality is it's falling, the sand is falling right through you because you can't do it. But if you're developing this practice, that moment can be felt in real time, in real space, in real, like as a baby, as a 27-year-old, you're in it. And that's the difference. Like so often when my children were young, I was absolutely so distracted by any number of things. And years go by. Don't let those years go by. It happens like that. It happens in a flash. And again, it doesn't take away what you're experiencing right now. But this practice allows you to be in the game, allows you to be in this moment. Go back to you.
When I think of attachment, it's not that, well, it's just, it's not self, right? We can feel strongly for something. And I think we can feel strongly for something in a wise manner, right? With restraint. But it's just about not making it your identity, right? And somebody, I don't know who said it before, but you know, identity of, maybe I shouldn't use this example, but identity of, you know, hockey player or identity of businessman, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what is my fire? Like, that has been quite aflamed over the last month that's taken me from this practice. It's business, right? My idea of an ego and identity with being a successful professional, right? Mm-hmm. That's a flame of mine. That's my fire right now. Wow. And that has become slightly untethered. And it's the attachment to that I have.
So your practice, how's that helping?
I'm coming back to it now.
Well, that's the rule.
Right. But I think what's important is I knew what was happening while it was happening.
That's the point.
Ignorant. And I needed to find my way back. Yeah. And, you know, this is the first time since I started this practice that it had gotten that intense. And I knew leading up to it, it was going to, you know, just like a baby. Like
that's intense.
It's going to be, right? But at least we're no longer ignorant to these teachings. Mm. And so we know what will happen.
Yeah.
In these moments, and we can be prepared for it. And
we're householders.
Yeah.
We have a fire hose of stuff.
I like that.
Right? Hose. Someone said that this, you know, we're not a monk who's kind of built this environment where I can absolutely be, you know, secluded. So the victory in your practice is that you saw it and you were aware of it. You took your next breath. And did it take the passion away? Maybe not, but you're aware of it. And then as your practice deepens, things fall away. Things absolutely fall away because it's not needed anymore. You see it in right view. Anyone else?
Nothing, just very excited that we're going to have a Sangha baby.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's our second one.
It's our second one?
Nina went on retreat.
Of course. Yeah. There you go.
The best pregnant woman.
Comment ever.
And I don't know if we'll probably have multiple ones. But John was in a role with something, a big argument, blew up, and we came back in, and you could just feel the passion. It was like it was female passion, And not to get into the specifics, but Nina, who is full on 9 months pregnant, at least, and it was a wonderful experience for her. And I was sitting next to her, and John was explaining it. And basically she said under her breath, and you know, Grounded said something, and she was like, "Well, we're just going to disagree about that." I was like, "Oh, geez." That was mommy to be energy. And, you know, again, and she had a baby shortly after that. Yeah. So, well, thank you, everyone. Again, this is the last class. We'll start Tuesday with our friend Jennifer, a special Tuesday appearance, which we don't get to see all the time. And then I think there's some open dates that people have to jump into, but we'll fill them out. And again, it's nobody replaces John Haspel. Just no one could riff on a subject like him. No one could, you know, be gentle with everyone and at the same time push me in the right direction. He was unlimited time for people, but you've got 8 teachers that can kind of fill in the gaps and learn along the way. And, you know, we'll keep it going. So thank you. We'll finish with Karaniya Metta-Sutta, as we always do. So please find your meditation posture. And this is what is done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. They are able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. They remain unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. They are peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. They do not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. They are always mindful that all beings be at ease, whatever living beings they may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. They are always mindful not to deceive another or despise any being in any state. They abandon anger and ill will with ease, never wishing harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, the wise disciple cherishes all living beings. They radiate kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, they maintain refined mindfulness. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, having completed the path, does not give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Thank you, everyone.